Hi, I'm Cyrus.
Hi, Cyrus.
I brought some notes that I wrote in the car on the way here. I'm just kidding. I kind of got a snarky sense of humor that's really helped me in my life and continues to help me today to make my time with you more fun. So, I am uncomfortable, and that's something that I get to share with you because, you know, I have a voice. And when I first came to this program, you know, just saying my name, you know, the first meeting you go to, it's so difficult. And when I was young, when I was a little kid, I had a speech impediment, you know. I had a really tough time saying R's, of which there happens to be one in my first name. And so saying my name, even when I was little, was something that I didn't really want to do. You know, I tended to, oh, hey, you know, like just, you know, oh, yeah, I'm around, you know. Like, so, you know, having a voice is so important, you know. We see, like, in our society, people who are good orators or people who can communicate and have strong communication skills, they're very powerful. When you can communicate your feelings, when you can communicate ideas, people listen. And from a personal perspective, you know, growing up in my family, I didn't have much of a voice. I didn't have. Maybe I had one and I didn't know it. And this program is definitely helping me to understand the power of my voice, the power of speech, good speech, bad speech. You know, as I go through this program, learning that maybe some of you guys can relate to having a critical parent, that, you know, when we focus, I'm not going to speak for you, when I focus on things that are negative, I'll get more negative things. It's like this, you know, this kind of curious experience. And I don't want or need any more negative things, you know. So it's practicing. I'm a musician, kind of. I was a bad musician because I didn't practice. And ACA is something that I'm practicing. And so that's been really huge for me. So to give you some background on my experience, you know, before we get to strength and hope and how the program has really impacted me, I grew up in a small town on the Central Coast, just north of San Luis Obispo, called Atascadero. And great town. My father grew up in Palo Alto. My mother grew up in Brentwood, California. And when they connected and got married, they moved to, I think my dad was getting his master's degree in agriculture at Cal Poly. And so they moved to a place that was equidistant between the two families. And I thought that was pretty pragmatic. And my parents were big, I'm going to sit down, because not only do I have a voice, but I get to take actions that make myself feel more comfortable now. Okay.
Would you like a regular chair?
No, I'm good. Thank you for asking, though. So, my parents were big partiers. They're kind of, they could throw a party. They would throw this 4th of July party every year. Well, when I was little, and there would be like 100 people, and they would have a horseshoe tournament, and, you know, Papa would, you know, cook a pig in the ground, and it was a, you know, live bands would come and play, and people would camp out, and on the piece of property that I grew up in an old craftsman house, you know, from like the 1920s, you know, raised, you know, floor. And we had sheep, lots of sheep, pigs, chickens, My dad has a really good green thumb. He had this big, beautiful organic garden. And that organic garden also included a greenhouse with a lock on it. And he grew and sold marijuana. And, you know, as a child, that was just something that was normal. That was, hey, Papa, why does the greenhouse have a lock? Because I don't want you playing in there when I'm at work. Oh, okay. You know, and at no time in my childhood did my dad ever say, hey, you don't talk about the greenhouse at school, or, you know, like, it's very trusting, you know, very laissez-faire parenting style my whole life. We were taught to be very independent, and my dad was not a rager, you know. He kind of ruled through shame, I guess. You know, the worst thing we could do would be to disappoint him. And yeah. And so I internalized all of that. And that's part of being a kid, right? We're in that environment. And so anyway, they have these big parties. People would be naked in the hot tub. There would be like, you know, I remember a huge platter of, you know, what I thought was powdered sugar, but no, don't touch that. You know, it's like cocaine. And the garage, there would just be those, you know, like 6-inch trays filled with marijuana that I'd be drying. And I'm just a kid, you know, just once, you know, kick the ball, and I didn't know that was not normal. I didn't really learn that that was not normal until I got into junior high, which maybe I was a little late to the program then, but, but, you know, this is, we only know what we know, right? And I'm okay with that. So, but maybe those should have been flags. I don't know. You know, the neighbors, maybe they knew, maybe they didn't say anything. I don't know. But one of the first experiences where I started to learn that things maybe weren't okay was when a neighbor down the street, a kid, Jonathan, on my soccer team, his stepdad was a coach, Eric. And Eric used to call me every once in a while when they would go out of town and say, hey, Si, could you come over and feed the rabbits for us while we're gone? You know, it's like fifth grade, fourth grade, you know, that's an easy task to give, you know, a child. I just had to walk down the street, you know, give them some pellets, you know, make sure that they had water. Rabbits are pretty self-sufficient. They have a lot of activities that they need to do all day long. And so I used to do that for them. And, you know, one day I'm just doing whatever and somebody pulls up in the driveway, and, you know, we didn't get a lot of visitors unless it was like party time. So we had a dirt driveway, and you could hear somebody pull up, and it's like, who's here? Who's here? I'd always get so excited if the phone would ring, because I'd be like, is it for me? And then it's like, if it was for me, I didn't know who it was going to be or what I would say, you know, like. And Eric shows up, and he's like, I'm here to talk to Cyrus. And I'm like, hey, Eric, what's going on? You know, he's like my soccer coach. And he's like, what happened? And I was like, I don't know what happened. And he was like, what happened with the rabbits? And I'm like, do you want me to feed your rabbits? And he's like, no, they're all dead. What happened with the rabbits? And I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about, Eric. Like, I don't know. And my dad overheard, and he went out there, and he was like, Cyrus, you know, like, you know, what's going on? You know, you're talking to my son, you know, like, whatever. So, turns out, Eric had called, like, the week before, and I guess he had spoken to my mom, but my mom was too drunk to remember to tell me to feed the rabbits.
Oh.
And so, that was one of my first experiences where my reaction to that was, I have to be hypervigilant, because mom's behavior now affects me, right? So my relationship with Jonathan became very strained, you know. It became very strained with my soccer coach. You know, these were my neighbors. And it was just one of those instances where, again, you know, my dad was like, Cyrus, it's not your fault, you know, but also not like in a very kind way. It was like, you know, it was embarrassing to him. He was experiencing humiliation. He was reacting to it however he could. And as these experiences started to become more prevalent, they started happening more often, you know, my mom's drinking started to get more and more out of control. I think he was just reacting to that in a way that he thought was best. So that was one of those experiences where that reaction, you know, even to this day, if I'm on a road trip with someone, it's really difficult for me to fall asleep in the car because I need to make sure that that driver is going to be alert and they're not going to fall asleep, you know, and I recognize these things today as, where does that come from, you know? So I could tie it back to that rabbit story, but it probably goes even further back, and I just haven't done enough work yet to find it. But in another instance, you know, one time my mom, it was like in the middle of the day, and she's like, "Hey, Si, jump in the car. I want you to meet somebody." And I'm like, "Okay, you know, it's great." So I jump in the car and we drive down the street, and Atascadero is not a really big town. So there's like one thoroughfare, which is El Camino, and there's another one, Morro Road, that goes out to Morro Bay. And Coronet's used to be on the corner of the 41 and El Camino. And we pull into the parking lot, and it's like this huge parking lot. Like, I don't know why there's not that many cars in Atascadero. But there was this huge, or maybe I was just really little. Now it's like a CVS and a Starbucks, and it's all changed. And so as we're pulling up, there's a guy in a truck, you know, and he's like on the outside of his truck, and my mom's all excited, and she's all excited, and you know, I start to get out, and she gets out, and she's like, "Do you know who that is?" And I'm like, "Yeah, that's Cyrus so and so." He was the only other Cyrus that I knew of, and he was the singer of a bluegrass band that used to play all of my parents' parties. And I was like, "I know exactly who that is, you know?" And she's like, "Oh, you do?" And I'm like, yeah, you know? And so as she starts to get out, he looks at her and goes, "I can't do this, Kathy. I'm really sorry. I'm really sorry. I can't do this." And he got back in his truck and, like, took off. And Mom's like, "Okay, I guess we're leaving." And I go to get back in the car, and she sits down at the steering wheel, and she's just shaking her head. She's like, I don't know. And then she looks at me, and she's like, "Don't tell your father." What? And I'm like, "Okay, you know, I'm a kid. You know, I just want to go kick the ball against the garage." And so we drive back down Morro Road, you know, and you know, it's like it's back to life. But you know, as I got older, that stuck with me. And I've really wrestled with whether or not my father is my father. And that's been really difficult for me in a way that I have no control over, and I acknowledge that. But just from a support standpoint, we all have roles that we play in our families. And in my family, I am kind of the black sheep. I don't really seem to fit in. And I'm the scapegoat. So you broke it, someone farted, someone ate the wrong thing, you know, like someone's in trouble, someone needs to be blamed. I might as well just raise my hand because I know it's coming. And so, as I've matured, I've realized that, you know, maybe there was some kind of like subliminal thing that was going on with my dad. You know, maybe this was under the surface somewhere, you know, somewhere along the line, but it didn't really hit home for me until I was in 10th grade. In a basic science biology class, and we were doing a exercise about how blood types work. And you know, your mom's blood type is this, your dad's blood type is that, and you can only be X, Y, or Z. And at that time I knew my blood type, and it wasn't X, Y, or Z. And I just had this visceral reaction. I just crumpled up the paper and I took an F. And I was a good student. My older brother, 4 years older than me, he was the golden child. Still is the golden child. And so he was the achiever. You know, his response to everything that was going on in school was achieving. And, you know, I was naturally competitive, and so I was always trying to compete with him. You know, it's like in... We're 4 years apart, so he was reading The Great Gatsby in high school, so I was reading it in junior high. You know, like, I was like, yeah, I'm doing my book report on the same book you're reading. I can understand that book. You know, like, I totally phoned that one in and, you know, just got through it, but, you know, that was kind of the mentality, right? And, trying not to get a lot too lost here, but, so that concept of you know, where do I fit in this family? And, you know, part of that too is like, I look nothing like my father. I'm a foot taller than him. He has, thin blonde hair and a receding hairline. He has blue-green eyes. I look a lot like my uncles on my mom's side. You know, my mom comes from a big family. She's one of 9 children, which is a lot for white people. Catholic family, you know, and I'm one of 23 grandchildren, and so, you know, all of the family functions on that side would be, you know, they're big parties, they're, you know, a lot of people, and, you know, the family of origin is very interesting, and I'm so thankful for the Yellow Book, because doing the step work has been really eye-opening for me, and that was one of the first things you do is you map out, you draw this, and I worked in the, as an audio engineer in the music industry initially when I got out of college, and so I wrote that thing like a signal flow chart, and I was so excited to do it, and I was excited to do it until I started to learn what it consisted of, which is so fascinating because on my dad's side, my dad only has one brother, and Rob is gay. So, you know, not only is Rob gay, but my grandfather left my grandmother for another man. And that was in the late 60s, early 70s, which was really, like, controversial and, I guess, extremely humiliating for my grandma because she's never let it go. But really healthy for me in that environment to growing up that people are people and we all deserve happiness. But my dad's mom, my grandmother, she's really into genealogy. So that's her hobby. So she goes to the reference libraries and she has all of these huge, cool maps that trace our family tree, you know, back in time. And it's like, I'm a descendant from this, you know, my, Giles Corey was pressed and crushed in the Salem witch trials. You know, I'm like a direct descendant of him. And so it's like when I was little and you learn that and you're like, oh, how cool, we're related to witches. Witches are cool, you know? And grandma's like, no, you know? She's like, can you imagine what your station in life would be if we still had all our wealth? You know, like they stole all our land. You know, it was like, you know, this was oppression and this was about money and, you know, like all this. And I was like, witches are cool, you know? Like, you know, being able to be a kid, as I'm older now, I realize that, you know, some of that stuff I missed out on. And, you know, being able to practice play is so important. And I'm so happy to be a part of a program that advocates for that because, learning to find that inner child and get them to be discovered and feel safe and to participate in the experience. And all along that path, you know, that's an integral part of that. I think that's super important. So I've totally veered away from my original, you know, plan, but that's okay. So long story short, I can just talk for hours. It's a long story. My mom's drinking increased and it got worse and worse and her behavior got worse and worse. And it got to a place where, you know, my dad, kind of threw up his hands. My dad, my brother, and I went on a boys camping trip, you know, to like the Sequoias. And this is pre-cell phones, and we come back to find mom was in jail. And she had taken Caitlin, my little sister, who's 5 years younger than I, so she probably was like 2 or 3, to the Mid-State Fair, which is in Paso Robles. If none of you have gone, it's a very interesting experience. And I guess mom got really plastered drunk, and she forgot that she brought Caitlin. And so somebody found this, you know, small girl wandering around the fair. And, you know, so all of a sudden mom's in trouble. Child Protective Services are involved. And this was like a big wake-up call to my dad. So he gets on the horn, you know, to call the rich parents down in L.A. What are you going to do for your daughter, you know? And, you know, it was like that night, you know, hey, kids, you know, mom's going to go away for a little while. She's kind of sick, you know, she's going to go to this place. She's going to go see her folks. She's going to get better. So she, you know, the next morning, mom, we put her on the Amtrak, and then we drove home. And I guess by the time mom got to Santa Barbara, she was so drunk that Amtrak kicked her off, put her in a taxi, COD. And then it was like 4 hours later, mom shows up in the driveway, and we're like, Papa, I thought you said mom, oh my, you know, Papa had to shell a bunch of money for a taxi, and then it was like, what's going on? And then she was on a bus the next day back to L.A., and she went to the Betty Ford Clinic, and pretty soon thereafter, the grandparents, my on my dad's side, came in to try and help us through that transition, and Papa and Aaron went up to down south to Betty Ford to go through their program, to go through their experience. And but I was too young. They said I was too young. I didn't get to go. I think I'm still a little bitter about that. because, you know, that hypervigilance was so important, you know. I always thought that everything was my fault. I you know, that overarching sense of responsibility, you know. I was the problem. I was the burden, you know, because most of the time it was my fault, or that was the story that, you know, I was accepting on a regular basis in my home. So, Papa comes back from that. He goes into the NA program, and like hard, like he went, you know, it was like, I remember there was this day where Papa cleaned out the greenhouse and everybody came one by one, and he was just giving away all that marijuana every day, you know, like it was just one day, and it was car after car after, here you go, with a big smile on his face, and all these people are like, we love you, we love you. And I was like trying to play basketball, I'm like, why are all these people coming over? And he's just like, it's a transition, it's gonna, you know. And then it was really funny because you know, you get to like 3 o'clock, I think he was giving it away all day until 3 o'clock, the police showed up.
Oh.
Two cars, they come, and I was like, and I had to go get Papa. I was like, Papa, the police are here, you know. And he's like, perfect timing. and he walks out, and he's like, guys, you're too late. I don't have anything left for you. And they started laughing, and you know, one of them got serious. But you know, that was, you know, this is a small town, and maybe they did that for his benefit. Maybe they did that for our benefit, you know. But maybe that was just a higher power looking out for him. I'm not sure. And so after that, you know, mom came back from Betty Ford. And I think she stayed sober, I think 27 days. And then she told us she went there to learn how to drink. And, you know, she did some little halfway house experiences, but, you know, kind of like the writing was on the wall. You know, she from like a textbook perspective, when they talk about an alcoholic being sick, my mom was truly sick. And, that's rough. So, feelings, right? I think before I feel. So it's very easy for me to come in and absorb and read and then ruminate and try and figure this stuff. I'm going to figure this all out. But the only real progress is made when we feel. For me, my progress is made when I start to feel. Because when I can feel, I can share. And when I share what I feel, it reduces the power that these experiences once had for me. So, it's big stuff. So, my dad continued. He continued on the NA path. And that meant I got to go to a lot of NA campouts and a lot of NA meetings and kind of hang out outside. And I was too young for Alateen. And there was this other program called Kids in Touch. And I don't think Kids in Touch made it. I don't think it's still around today. But I was in that program for like about a year and a half or so. And it was based, it's very similar to any 12-step program. We would go and talk. Although, you know, it was kind of this interesting small town experience because there's these rooms at the far end of town and everybody knows that's where AA and NA is, right? So there's like this certain like, you know, stigma regarding, you know, self-help or self-recovery, and it's like, we don't want that in the middle of town, in small little Tascadero. Oh, we want that on the outside, you know? It's like, classism or racism through property values. I don't know. It's like, that's the way I look at that. And, so I would show up and there would be kids in there from my class or from other grades that you would see. And it was kind of like this unspoken thing that we had with each other where we knew that where we were coming from, there was dysfunction in the home. And we got to share that in a way that we needed. You know, that was important for us to acknowledge that. But the irony was, is none of the other kids wanted to share. So I learned to talk. And I was okay with just, you know, running my mouth. And then I would share and they'd be like, thank you, Cyrus. Would anybody else like to share it? No. Cyrus, would you like to share again? And then so-and-so did this, and then so-and-so said that, and then, you know, because I was looking at it like more like, how do I fix this? You know, I broke this, how do I fix this? And I never, you know, in all fairness, I never got any answers from Kids in Touch. And, you know, so it's fascinating because, you know, I've been saying the Serenity Prayer since I was small. You know, I was in like fifth, sixth grade when I started saying the Serenity Prayer, but I never really applied it to myself, you know, until I started coming here. That's night and day, you know. There's a lot of amazing stuff just in that small prayer, right? And, you know, prayer was not something that I had any kind of validating experience with either. So, you know, the religion thing was very fascinating when I started to work the Yellow Book. And, you know, they start to talk about religion and how does religion play into your home. And my mom was an emergency Catholic. That's what I... she only seemed to start praying when she screwed something up. And, you know, I would see her with her St. Christopher medal more than I would any kind of other thing, which I think is really fascinating looking back now. But, so that side of the family is Catholic, and, I really had to, stand up for myself and advocate, later in life. I took care of my grandparents before they both died, and I would drive grandma to church every week, and I would drop her off, and then I would come back and pick her up, and she would always be like, come on in, come in, and I'm like, no. Me and Jesus are cool, we're just like in different places, you know? Like, so, you know, like learning to be tolerant, right? And my grandmother on my dad's side is Episcopalian, and I would go with her to her church and prune the ferns and, you know, do that whole thing. You know, I played soccer with the Mormons, I lived in a Buddhist household, you know, I went to school with a bunch of Muslim kids in college, and, you know, for me, I think religion is great. So long as it's not hurting anybody. And, you know, the whole point is just to live our lives better. And everybody needs their own way to do that. So, where am I? So we covered, I was a child once. there was some dysfunction in the home, a little bit. And so, You know, NA was interesting. My dad participated in that, you know, and he was clean and sober for a considerable amount of time. He's not anymore. And he made that choice later in life. And he's been okay. It hasn't really affected him. And so, but as a child, you know, when he did that, he was kind of my champion, right? Because he was recognizing that he had to step up and take responsibility. But he did it in a way that it wasn't like he wanted to, I guess. You know, there was a certain amount of resentment that was like the undertone that I always felt my whole life. When he would talk about it, or when, you know, any opportunity to bash my mother, you know, he would take well after the divorce. Up until recently, but I'll get there. I'm trying to do this in chronology and it's tricky. It's tricky. But, so after the divorce, you know, my mom would got, she was kind of out of control. So maybe before the divorce, I guess, before the divorce, during the divorce, divorces are tricky. I think they take a little bit of time. Mom moved out. We were all living with my dad. He's the one who could have a job and pay bills and was sober. And mom was kind of a loose cannon. And she didn't like the law. She didn't like rules. And, you know, one of the interesting things about my mom is she's a closet alcoholic. You know, so I've seen her drink maybe twice in my life. But it was the type of thing where she would hide wine all over the house. So it'd be hidden in her closet. It'd be hidden in the bathroom closet. It'd be hidden in our room closet. It was hidden in the garage. It was hidden in the barn. I'm sure she probably had some in her car. We figured this out after she moved out because my dad cleaned out the whole place. And it was jug after jug after jug of this cheap wine. And it was so humiliating because my dad tried to give it away. And these people were like, we won't even cook with that. And I was like, it was so painful because I was like, this is all you do, Mom? And these people like won't even cook with it? You know, like, it was so interesting. But the way that that would manifest itself in the home would be, my mom would use that as a response to the triggers from her childhood, no doubt. And so, birthdays, holidays, you know, it's Easter, it's Christmas, it's your birthday, it's, I don't know, what else people celebrate on their holiday. Okay, you know, the holiday starts great, and then she's just smashed and causing a huge scene. And, you know, it would be the same thing like soccer tournaments, you know, at the pizza party, she'd be hitting on the other dads. And they'd be like, sorry, you gotta take your mom home now, you know. And, you know, that behavior just like continued. So even after the divorce, you know, I think, you know, my mom was just lashing out. And so her behavior got worse. And, Papa trained us up, you know. So he had a restraining order against her because, you know, my mom managed to hit Caitlin at another time, and so Papa was like, you're way out of control, this has to stop. So Mom had hid keys all over the property, and, you know, I was kind of a latchkey kid. I don't know why, but Aaron got rides and Caitlin got rides, but I walked to and from school. And, you know, I'm a middle child, but I don't think that's what it is. Maybe that's what it is, but, I would walk home from school, and I would have like an hour and a half to myself to watch Yo! MTV Raps, which was really good for my cultural identity, you know, being from this small town that was predominantly white. And I would eat Cheetos, and I'd watch Garfield, and then when everybody come home, I would go escape, and I'd go outside. I was a little jock. I'd go play sports, and I would have all of these fantasies in my head that would take me away from my life. But sometimes Mom would show up, and if Mom showed up, the rules were you had to ask her to leave. If she didn't leave, you had to call the police. And, you know, as a small child, that sucked, you know. And, you know, I was put in that position three times, and the first time I begged and begged and begged Mom to go, and she did, and she wasn't happy about it. So she was mad at me. I felt bad because I was keeping secrets from my dad and I wasn't following the rules. And you know, it's like, I'm a people pleaser. I want to do what you want so I can get your love, right? I do that over and over and over again. And I did that in, you know, personal relationships. I did that in work, you know, trying to find work relationships where I could repeat that pattern. And so in one instance, she showed up and she was way smashed. And I was like, Mom, you have to go. And I remember I was crying because I didn't want to have to call the police. But she like walked right into the house. I'm like, what are you doing here? You can be here, you know? And the police showed up. And she was so combative and she was hitting them and they like hogtied her. And the police officer was like, sorry, you have to see this, son, you know? And that was horrible. That was really painful, even now. And I've told that story. I've shared that story like three. This is like the fourth time I've shared that. I know that that pain, that grief in me is really in there. That was rough. I felt like I was between two worlds that I was dependent on. And you know, ironically, I had that same experience again when I graduated from high school. I graduated from high school and this was one of the first times that I was, you know, having a praise deficit. I was going to get to experience praise. I graduated from high school, you know. And Papa was like, as soon as you're done walking, you know, and they throw the hats and everything, you have to come straight back to the car. And I was like, well, yeah, but we had to take pictures and stuff. And all my family came from L.A. And so this is post-divorce. My dad is now remarried. And my grandparents came from L.A. and my mom was there. You know, but this restraining order is still in place. So things are tense and uncomfortable. And you're like, okay, you know, like, how do I go and say thank you, thank you, and then go and say thank you, thank you. And I take pictures with, you know, my dad's side of the family, and then they all start to head to the parking lot. And then I go and, you know, I go to see my mom and, you know, my grandparents, and, you know, I'm taking all the pictures. And they all, so, you know, those, we've all been to graduations, they take forever. And then you get to that's the good part, right? The pictures, and it's almost over. And then I'm like, okay, I gotta go, okay, I gotta go, I gotta go. And my mom's got this thing where, she doesn't really start to engage you until it's time to go. Cause, you know, that's procrastination for her, or whatever it is, because of those feelings that she doesn't want to experience, or whatever it was going on for her. And so, I raced back to the parking lot to find that my dad had left me. And so this is, you know, I only got so much time, but this is not the first time I've been left before by my dad in an experience like that. But I thought because I was older, you know, like it wasn't going to happen again. And then so I raced back, you know, there's only one high school in Tascadero. You know, it's not like huge, right? You know, it's a small town, but there's two parking lots and they're on opposite ends of the campus. So where my dad parked, and then I raced back to see if I could catch a ride with grandma and grandpa, you know, who had come from that. Everyone was gone. So I walked to a payphone, and I call, hey, where'd you guys go? You know, I must have missed you, you know. You're grounded, walk home, I'm so upset with you, I can't even talk, click. And I just sat on the curb, crying. For like 2 hours, because it was like, this is not about poor me, you know, it's really not. It's just this is part of my experience. You know, my older brother was kind of like the golden child, so it was like every accomplishment, and don't get me wrong, he markets the shit out of himself. He is really, really good at self-promotion. And part of that was he learned to do that as a small child. He's the oldest grandchild. So when you have 8 aunts and uncles that all want to know what you have to do, he would have this manufactured pitch and he would practice it in the car for 4 hours before he'd get there. And then it would be like showtime for him. The irony is now we're adults. He's an introvert. That exhausts him, which I think is kind of funny. But for me, that was supposed to be like a time for me to shine. And that praise deficit was just hit with more, it's your fault. you did something wrong. So, ironically, my baseball coach was delivering pizzas in that neighborhood, and he happened to drive by, and Andy was like, Cyrus, what are you doing on the curb in your cap and gown? And I was like, so I don't want to talk about it. He's like, do you need a ride? And I was like, yes, please. And, you know, that's one of the great things in life that we experience, is that kindness, right? Gentle humor and love are good, and kindness is something else. You know, we can do good deeds and be selfless, and the kindness that we experience sometimes from strangers or from people that we know, or just the people that just come out of the ether and show up in times of need, is pretty remarkable. So, so that was a good start to the summer. And, you know, it's just interesting how we navigate these things and how we experience them. Because for me, you know, I just reacted. I had a lot of anger back then, and I wanted to escape. And so, you know, in high school and into college, you know, one of the ways that I escaped was isolating myself. I spent a lot of time by myself, and music. You know, I ditched soccer for a drum set, and I started playing in bands, and you know, I found this really interesting, like, movement was going on when I was young, and it was like, there was all this music that supported politics, and so I got really into punk rock, and I started to learn about, you know, these bands were singing about change, and they wanted to change the political system, and they wanted to change, you know, environmental rights, and they wanted to change all these things, and everybody interprets things differently, and so it was a big, like vegan straight edge movement. And I got really hard into that when I was 15. I've been vegan for like 21 and a half years, almost 22 years now. And it was something like that hypervigilance I recognize now is a big part of why I made that choice. Because I was like, I can save the world. I could do this. I could change my diet. And people won't starve in foreign countries because it's more sustainable. And it requires less water and it requires less resources. And, you know, when you're 15, you're like, you know, I know everything, I can do this. And then the other component was being drug free, you know, and these, you know, these bands were singing about all this rhetoric to be, you know, clean and sober, because a lot of them had experienced similar things, you know, that we had experienced in their childhood, and they were using music to have a voice. And it, you know, I bring it back to this voice thing because I didn't have a voice. So I was seeking something that could speak for me. And that was a tricky thing to navigate, because I learned that, you know, when you don't drink, people don't invite you to parties. When you don't do the drugs, they don't want you to be around them. And until they can't drive home, and they need you to come pick. You guys, Cyrus, can you come get us? Nobody can drive. I'm like, you guys are a bunch of dicks. You don't invite me out, but you want me to come pick you up? And, you know, so then they would start asking me I was available to go out, and you know, I found myself getting into some trouble, but not in the way you think. You know, it's just I was a little smart ass, you know. So those were interesting experiences, and I've been drug free my whole life, basically. You know, I think I was in, you know, because when the divorce was happening, you know, that was like sixth grade, and that was when my friends were starting to experiment with drugs and alcohol. And I look in the mirror, and I look like my mom. And my dad's drug speech to us was like, Cy, there's some really cool drugs out there. And a lot of them you should try, you know? But the thing that you gotta know about drugs and alcohol is if you let it take control of your life, it's really difficult to get that control back. And you have two examples. You have your mom, and you have me. And I was like, thanks, Dad. You know, I look in the mirror, it's all mom. You know, I'm like, thanks, Dad. So I took that to heart. I took it hard, you know. And I hope to be the coolest straight edge person you'll ever meet. You know, like I gravitated. All my friends were drug dealers. All my friends would drink and smoke, and You know, my first like four girlfriends were like, you know, they were ravers and they were doing acid and ecstasy and, you know, they were chasing whatever hole they were trying to fill. And I was doing the same thing because I was trying to fix this relationship with my mom, mm-hmm. you know, through someone else. I don't know if anybody else in the room can relate to that experience. But, you know, that was one of those things where you just keep banging your head against the wall because I didn't recognize that I had choice. I didn't recognize that I had a voice. I didn't understand how to set boundaries. You know, I would just react and start the pattern over again. And adulting is hard. It's tough. Doing the right thing and, you know, being disciplined and, you know, certain areas of my life I could be extremely disciplined. And in others, you know, it's like my blood type. I still don't know what my blood type is. I have this like mental block that I can't remember it. I'm healthy. I go, I get my physicals. I get my lab work done. And then I look at the paper and I just kind of forget. And I'll get there. That's one of those things that I, you know, I really wanted to do because it's kind of important, right? But it's, you know, it's fascinating. So fast forward, you know, I think, I'm doing okay. You know, not this last Christmas, but the Christmas before, for example. Well, I guess I missed a big component in this whole story, in my story. So Christmas is an important thing. Not because I enjoy that holiday, it's actually my least favorite holiday. My favorite holiday is Halloween. Because I'm an October baby, and I've always loved Halloween. Maybe that's the secret pagan deep in my roots somewhere. That hasn't come out yet. But Christmas, 11 years ago. Okay. So normal Christmases, they would always be destroyed. You know, mom would get smashed and Christmas sucked. And it was always that's why I don't like it. You know, it was always a negative experience. Another reason was, you know, my brother would always convince me to go in on the gift. And, you know, if we combined our gifts, Cyrus, we could get a much bigger gift. And it would always be something that he wanted and not something that I would want. And then, you know, he would sell me and I was like so excited because, you know, he was spending all his time with me selling me. And then Christmas would come and then Aaron would get a gift and I didn't really have anything to play with afterwards. So, you know, I'm better about that now. But that last Christmas with my mom was a stark contrast. I described the procrastination thing and we went into that Christmas and we had a lot of certain amount of time and as soon as we show up, oh, we gotta go, so we could try and extract the most quality time with her. And she was attentive and she was sober and we had food and we shared cards and we gave little gifts and we just kind of caught up and we gave our hugs. And then we got back in the car and we're driving down Portola Road and I just kind of like, you know, we're like almost adults, you know, we're adults. I'm like 24 or something like that. Aaron's 28, Caitlin's 19. And like that was the best Christmas with mom, right? And we're all kind of like in shock. And then, yeah, it was so weird. Like we turned the corner and like 45 days later, she passed away. Oh. And so it's like one of those things where, you know, all that drinking with her had caught up to her in her 50s. I think she was 54 when she died. And, she had a couple close calls, like ulcers in her esophagus ruptured and she almost bled out, you know, and it was like, that was super traumatic. And when she did pass, we were all there with her. And I was so happy to have that experience. This is real, guys. This is real. But it's interesting because it was one of those things like, I think she knew more than she was letting on about the state of her health. And she was able to push through and give us that quality Christmas. So that was a good one. So, you know, the story was always, you know, mom was an alcoholic, right? So after she died, it was like, Yeah, problem solved, right? You know, like, where, you know, when your mom dies and, you know, all this dysfunction goes with her. I couldn't have been further from the truth. And so, you know, I continued to, you know, continue my patterns like the next, you know, 9.5, 10 years. And it wasn't until I got to ACA. I've been in ACA for 20 months now. This program is remarkable, absolutely remarkable. So huge for me. Christmas 2 years ago, 7:30 in the morning, I'm like, "Good morning, Grandma, Merry Christmas." And she's like, "You're a big disappointment to your father." I'm like, "Fuck you very much. Why did I even wake up?" You know? And it was like one of those experiences where it's just, you know, that role that I have in my family, you know, despite my personal growth or the things that I do, I can't expect the people in my family to grow or to change or to view me differently. And I have no control over them. And so I'd already been in the ACA program for a certain amount of time at this point. And I was so proud of myself because I was learning to not only have a voice, but to exercise it. And I was like, "Well, you know, Grandma, thank you for that feedback at 7:30 in the morning. But if Papa has a problem with me, he's a grown man and he can tell it to me himself. He doesn't need his mother to do that for him anymore." And I said, "You know what else? We all spend our time, you know, to come here to be together as a family. And, you know, because this is supposed to be a time of joy. And it's up to you whether or not you want to make this a positive experience or a negative experience. And good luck with that. I'm going to go eat breakfast now and try and salvage whatever this Christmas is supposed to be," right? And I was so proud to go back and tell my sponsor. You know, but after that experience, it was really curious because I'm driving home and I was carpooling with my sister and her husband and my niece and sharing. And it's like, I have, really healthy relationships with my older brother and my younger sister now. And, you know, I have three stepbrothers and a half sister and my dad remarried. And, it's really fascinating that my stepmom, Rita, has been huge in my life. I love her very much. She has showed me unconditional love since she has met me, which has been so huge for me to have a female figure in my life that wasn't, you know, trying to manipulate me or didn't need anything from me, and just you know, not too involved, not overly involved, but just, you know, always there. And, you know, so I'm very grateful for that. And, I'm such a scatterbrain. This is such an awesome experience. I'm so happy to be doing this. So anyway, after Christmas, you know, Papa calls me up because he catches wind. He's got to drive Grandma back home to Palo Alto. And he's like, "Sigh, I didn't say anything to Grandma about, you know, she's old, you know, I can't control her. She's been bashing my dad, you know, and Grandpa had been dead for, you know, like 10 years or something like that. She's been bashing my dad, you know, ever since he left her." And a curious thing happened after he spoke those words to me on the phone. Because, you know, the other thing that ACA, despite my motor mouth, taught me to do is to listen. And I, you know, when my dad was talking to me, I just let, okay. Mm-hmm. And since he told me about his mom bashing his dad, he has not said a single bad thing about my mom. Which is great, which I appreciate. But it's kind of interesting to see how that works, right? Because we inherit, you know, this bundle, this gift that keeps on giving of para-alcoholism or, you know, whatever way it chooses to manifest itself. And, you know, drawing a map of our family origin is all well and good in a theoretical sense, but it's only as good as the actions and, you know, the feelings that we're willing to accept in ourselves and the change that we're able to make, I guess you would say, or for myself, that I'm able to make. And that's been my experience. And so, you know, and then shortly thereafter, I worked up the courage to talk to my dad about a lot of these things that had gone on in my childhood, which was really fascinating, you know. I talked to him about, you know, whether or not he was my father, and which was huge, you know. And it was very healing, you know. It's one step at a time, one day at a time. And, you know, his response was really great. You know, he told me, "Sai, you're my son no matter what." And he said, "You weren't named after Cyrus, the bluegrass singer. I chose that name." Yes, that was the first Cyrus that we ever met, and I thought it was a super cool name. And, but I don't think he's your father, you know? And I don't need a DNA test to prove it. I'll always be your dad. But some of that other behavior, we're still not there yet. So I'm still the scapegoat. I'm still the black sheep. You know, it's like I go home, like my little sister's graduating from college. She's the youngest. There's a 15-year gap there. And, Sai, you gotta set up all the tables and chairs. You gotta do this. You gotta go do that. I'm like the little whipping boy, right? And I'm like, yeah, but now I have a voice. I just want you to know, you didn't ask Aaron to do anything. You didn't ask Kaylin to do anything. You didn't ask Jack to do anything. You didn't ask Michael to do anything, you know? And he's like, yeah, I know, I'm asking you. And I'm like, okay, we're not there yet. But that's okay, because I said something for myself, and that's all that matters. And now I know that I have a choice, and, you know, maybe I don't go to that function next time, or maybe I can say, no, I'm not setting up the chairs. I can sit on the grass. You know, so, you know, it's fascinating, and you know, so I'm going to talk a little bit about ACA, right? So one of the things that's been huge in my recovery, since I came into this program is going to meetings. And I go to meetings religiously. I go every week, right? You know, for the past 20 months, I've been going every week. Sometimes twice a week, sometimes three times a week, you know. And another thing I did was I got a sponsor. And initially, you know, I asked around, and everybody told me to go with this one guy who I love to death, and he's awesome, and he's been in the program a long, long time. And but he'd sponsored a lot of people, and I felt like he should retire, and like he's done his service, and I needed to find somebody that was closer to how I learn and experience. And there was an individual in one of the meetings that I would go to, and he was a thinker, and he would think before he felt. And I was like, this guy would be the perfect, you know, he'd been in the program for like 6 years, and he was perfect for me. And I approached him, and he's like, yeah, I'll do this, but only if you're going to work the yellow book. And I've been working that yellow book with him every week for the last 20 months. And that's huge for me. So attending meetings, fellowship. Fellowship is a huge part of this program. Every Monday night in Thousand Oaks afterwards, we go out to get food. And we hang out, and not everybody orders food, you know, but it's an opportunity to meet new people. And part of the thing that I've learned is, you know, I didn't have the best examples for love. I didn't have the best examples for friendship or how that works. And so I'm learning how to be a friend and how to accept friendship, how to give support, how to listen, how to accept support, how to reach out. Reaching out is huge. Reaching out is a big part. Service. I took a service position as soon as I started ACA because I knew it would make me go, because I'm a people pleaser and I'm codependent and I don't want to let anybody down. So I knew that that would keep me showing up, and it's worked. And, you know, as I evolve, service becomes something different. It's not about just showing up. It's about, you know, releasing this part of you, you know, and it comes back. So another thing that I like to do is I like to go to random meetings. I like to go to meetings that are not in my area, where I don't know necessarily anybody. because that reaffirms my faith in the program. That reaffirms my faith in the process, where, you know, it's not, you know, don't, you know, I'm so thankful for all the people that traveled to come and support me in speaking tonight. But sometimes, you know, you go into a meeting and you don't know anybody, and you share because that's what we're there to do. And, you know, it's, the process works. The program works. And that is such a cool experience, because you have that I'm the newcomer feeling again. And, you know, you think everyone's going to be judging you, and they're all going to, and you know what? I'm trying to get over that. And so what I found in this program is that I have to practice. If I want to have a voice, I have to practice my voice. And I have to share the hard stuff, and I have to be courageous, because I'm an actor, right? And I'm an actor in this world. I'm not an actor, but. And I'm not a victim. You know, victimization was a thing that I've struggled with my whole life. You know, I was a scapegoat, I did this, it's my fault, you know, and then and then we create those environments or habits to find other people that mimic or mirror these people to keep us in our comfort zone. And I'm trying to do as much contrary action as possible so that I can evolve. And having that praise deficit is difficult, because sometimes we don't recognize how much progress we've made. And sometimes we need the support of those around us that care about us to give that feedback, so that we can do the hard work and look in that mirror and do it for ourselves. You know, learning to love and accept myself is a huge part of my journey. And for anybody that sat in a meeting with me knows that I love to read the goals at the end of the meeting. And I have read the goals so many times. And it's been huge for me. Because when I first started reading those, I get to the third one and I'm ready to cry, because my critical parent takes over. Oh, you can't do this. You know, I'm loving authority figures. Are you kidding me? You know, like, just getting through that, learning to love myself. And, you know, be attracted to, you know, people who take care of themselves and love themselves, and, you know, not to react anymore. And those goals are huge. And so another thing that I've done is in learning to keep my own voice is music is still a big part of my life. And after I leave every meeting, I would sing, you know, cause I go to, my meeting's in Thousand Oaks, but I live in Woodland Hills. So it's still like, you know, 20-25 minute. Depends on traffic. So I love to drive. I'm one of those race car drivers that I apologize if I cut you off. But I love to sing in my zone, right? And you know, the funny thing about music is a lot like life. We can find people that have a voice of, you know, what's going on with you in your experience. You know, that feeling component. It's always been so difficult for me, but when I watch movies, I can cry. When I listen to, you know, lyrics, I can identify, I could try and get some of that out. And then so it's like learning to sing was my way of doing that. But then I would try and mimic the person singing, right? You know, it's like, oh, I'm gonna get, you know, I don't think I'm a very good singer, but, you know, now, through this program, I'm starting to sing in my own voice. And that's remarkable for me. You know, I was talking to a fellow traveler in the intermission before I got started, and we were talking about how so much of this has to do with just little changes, right? Because we've all survived our own story. We've survived our own experiences. And we have to work, and you know, we're seeking love, and we're seeking acceptance, and we need to do these things and feel, and communicate, and just small changes in good speech, you know, being good to ourselves. So another thing that I did when I first came to ACA was I made a contract to be good to myself. And because I'm so intellectual, I really took that to heart, and I'm disciplined. And so all of a sudden, now because of ACA, right, an opportunity to come up, hey, Cy, can you do this for me? Is this good for Cyrus? That has been huge shift in my perspective, where all of a sudden I'm thinking, hey, is this good for me? That would force me to stop. It would force me not to react and just to think, what do I want? Is this something I want to do? Is this something that I want? Is this, and that is very small little thing to do, but huge, huge in my recovery, because a big component of that now is also self-value. And valuing myself in a way that I never did before. You know, these are small things. You know, like ever since I was little, I never ate breakfast. There was no time. It was wake mom up. We got to go to school. Okay, you just go. You know, and it was like make a lunch. You know, Papa never let us have hot lunch. We never got any money. And so he always had a pantry. There was always food and we could make our own food. But I was lazy. I would grab the Doritos. I got anything I could trade, you know. For a better lunch. And I was taking care of myself, but you know, that was the concept. And now it's like, I get to make lunch for myself. This isn't, you know, the dishes. Who wants to do this? I hate doing this. Now I get to do the dishes for myself. It's that kind of like altering that good speech where this is an opportunity to do something for me. And not in like a blown out, narcissistic, selfish way. But in like a healthy way, you know, of learning to find that balance, learning to integrate, you know, healthy behaviors into my life. And, thank you for letting me share. I think I'm cleaned out. So, thank you so much.